From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his cover article for The Atlantic magazine, the journalist Graham Wood offers a provocative metaphor for understanding the rise to power of the militant group the Islamic State, or ISIS. He describes it as like the realization of a dystopian alternate reality where David Koresh or Jim Jones survived and ruled over a group of not hundreds, but some 8 million people. Wood says the West misunderstands the nature of ISIS. It's not a political movement as much as a religious one. He says it's a state that rejects peace as a matter of principle and is ideologically committed to genocide. Today in the program, Wood is joining us to trace the intellectual roots of ISIS and explain why it's critical the West understands it. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Graham Wood says all this confusion in the West about the militant group ISIS is in some ways understandable. In his cover story in The Atlantic magazine, he describes the Islamic State as a hermit kingdom. He writes, "Few have gone there and returned. But still, there's enough to begin to answer some very important questions. We know," he says, "the Islamic State rejects peace as an legal and philosophical principle, in fact, that it's committed to genocide, and it believes itself a lead player in the imminent end of the world, an actual apocalypse." But Wood says it's also important to understand that the Islamic State has painted itself into a corner in some ways, that it can't really maintain its place in the world if it changes or compromises in any way. Wood says the West hasn't really understood some of these things. In fact, he says we don't really get the nature of the Islamic State in crucial ways. And so the response has been confused at times and muddled. Today in the program, he's joining us to get at some of the most basic questions about the Islamic State. What is it? Where did it come from? What are its intentions? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Graham Wood is a contributing editor at The Atlantic and The New Republic. He also lectures on political science at Yale University. You can find a link to his cover story at The Atlantic on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Graham Wood is joining us today from a studio on the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut. And Graham Wood, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Well, I guess I want to begin broadly before we get into some of the particulars that you write about in your article. One of the central questions you get at early on, you know, just what is the Islamic State? Because you say the U.S. government and others don't really understand that question, which has led to what you call some, you know, significant strategic errors. So let me maybe start broadly there. As I said, we'll get to the specifics. But what do you think is the central misunderstanding in the West about ISIS?
Well, I'd first say that it's not just me who says that the U.S. government doesn't understand the Islamic State. The U.S. government says the same.
Right.
They've been very clear that they say we haven't really even begun to understand this. Mm-hmm. We haven't been able to figure out what it's all about, why it's attracting people. And what I've tried to do in my article for the current Atlantic is to just describe what the Islamic State considers itself to be and to find out what it is in its own self-conception. And they're, in fact, admirably clear about this. They say that they are a caliphate. Yeah. They say the very specific rules that a caliphate must follow and that a caliph must follow to be valid in his rule. And essentially what it comes down to is they wish to overthrow the whole political order of the world by getting rid of borders as a matter of principle, mm-hmm. and having an ever expanding caliphate, the state that grows inexorably and that refuses to turn over territory, and in the territory that it rules has a deep commitment to the Islamic State's own variety of Sharia law. Mm.
I'm not sure if there was just one particular moment when the Islamic State really emerged out of the shadows, but you do mention July of last year. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi steps up to this pulpit of the great mosque in Mosul, Iraq. That seemed like an important moment in this story. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, it was a moment that really shocked a lot of people who had been watching the Islamic State's precursor organization. Because, you know, we had really thought of this like Al-Qaeda. We had thought of it as a group that was underground, that operated in terrorist cells. Although it was clear that they had controlled territory, such as the city of Raqqa in Syria, for over a year at that point. But then there was this moment when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who had very recently been proclaimed caliph, he stepped up into the pulpit in this mosque in Mosul, Iraq, a city that had just been taken over by the Islamic State, the third largest city in Iraq, and he just emerged from the shadows in both a real and metaphoric way. He became a public figure. He was in HD and he spoke at great length, and suddenly ceased to be this person who was hiding and perpetrating attacks on the sly. And instead was saying, look, I am a leader of a state that is on not just equal footing, but is supreme. And I'm no longer some kind of terrorist leader, but the leader of something that is different from anything you've seen before.
One of the things that's interesting, and we'll break down some of the differences, for example, between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda as we go, but one really crucial one seems to be this idea of territory. You mentioned that the Islamic State, for example, honors Osama bin Laden in some ways. They believe that his jihad was noble, but it, in some ways it seems like they also think of it as kind of too old school for, ironically enough, I suppose, for this group of believers, if I understand it crucially, bin Laden didn't care about territory. The Islamic State, for the Islamic State, territory is critical.
That's correct. So they really believe that the most important thing is that the caliph be able to implement Sharia law. And of course, Osama bin Laden, he shared that goal. He wanted to have a state that could implement Sharia law. But he was not really even contemplating the possibility that there might be, on a classical prophetic model, a caliphate. And so he was thinking about having this underground movement, which we call Al-Qaeda, that would perpetrate attacks on the West and exact political costs and concessions. Whereas with the Islamic State, as you correctly say, the territory is all. They believe that if they seize territory and they have the capability of implementing Sharia, then it's their absolute obligation to do so. And so in that speech that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi gave in Mosul in July of last year, he spoke of this quite plainly. He said, look, I've got this big burden on me and I hope I can carry it. And if I don't do it right, then I want you to correct me. But that burden consisted of implementing Sharia law. And that's not something you can do if you don't actually control territory.
Nice.
So it's a very different kind of strategy that the Islamic State's pursuing. And you know, the fact that we were looking at it for so long as this kind of underground organization, when it's clear, actually, from some of the statements going back years, that the caliphate model is what they were eventually going to aim for. The fact that we were looking at them as the underground organization, I think, is part of our misunderstanding of the group.
Give us a sense of the scale and the stakes in this story, because I mentioned this earlier in an introduction that you know, to understand it, you have to imagine David Koresh or Jim Jones surviving, you know, the things that eventually killed them and wielding absolute power over something like 8 million people. I mean, does that give us a sense of what we're talking about?
Yeah, and I think it also gives us a sense of how this is certainly not unique to Islam, that there would be a kind of apocalyptic death cult. And that's the other important part of this equation,
of
is
course,
that they have very strong views about the imminent fulfillment of an apocalyptic prophecy. But yeah, they control an area that is larger than the United Kingdom, that has 8 million inhabitants. And they're expanding through pledges of loyalty from places like Afghanistan, most prominently Libya. So to have David Koresh in his compound in Waco, Texas, I think that's something that could, you know, the fact that many people died there is obviously a tragedy,
sure.
But it's not something that really threatened many people outside of that immediate area. Instead, we've got a group that believes that there will be an end time struggle that they will be part of, in which there will be hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people killed. And we're talking about in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
So I think we should be concerned about that.
One of the things you say we're not understanding very well in the West is the nature of ISIS's, as you put it, their medieval religious nature. And I want to break that down, but I wanted to get at something you write about that. Because you say that the West has been misled by a dishonest campaign to deny the medieval nature of ISIS. What do you mean by that?
Well, there have been many attempts to analyze first Al-Qaeda and now ISIS that have really emphasized that although they say that they wish to return to 7th century legal norms, some 7th century even practices of dress and even dentistry, that really they're a very modern group. And I think in the case of Al-Qaeda, that was much more true than it is of ISIS. Al-Qaeda had this kind of insurgent cellular structure that was very characteristic of insurgent groups that have existed mostly in the last 100 years or so. And its members really navigated the world, the modern world, very, very efficiently and successfully. Whereas with ISIS, I think the shoe fits, the medievalist shoe fits quite a bit better. They're very concerned about a kind of rejection of Islamic tradition beyond the last, beyond the first couple centuries of Islam. And they are insistent on this at a level of policy too. They are looking at Islamic texts in a way that they think conforms with the interpretations of the first companions of the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
And I think in principle, you would have found many people in Al-Qaeda who agreed with that theological view. In ISIS, it seems to be implemented with a seriousness that we had never seen before. And so I think calling them a medievalist group in that sense is simply factually accurate.
It's so interesting that you write that they speak in codes and in terms of phrase that sound very strange. For example, you say to non-Muslims. And there's one example you mention, one chief spokesman for ISIS, who called on Muslims in Western countries to find the infidels and, among other things, smash them with rocks, and this was sort of the critical sentence here, destroy their crops. Talk about that, because it does show that they really have an interesting way of speaking that's embedded in the past.
Yes, you know, they make these threats toward the West, and it has to be said that they're extremely verbose. They have long, long statements that they put out, describing in detail what they're going to do, why they're going to do it, quoting, of course, scripture, describing those things. And there's a reason that these aren't usually excerpted very at any great length, and that is that a lot of the allusions in here really need to be unpacked and spelled out by experts to be understood. And the devastation of crops would be a good example of that. When Sheikh Adnani, the spokesman for the Islamic State, mentioned the devastation of crops, the poisoning of wells, these seem like odd things to mention in a modern context where, you know, food is something that we're not in any acute shortage of. So
right.
You devastate a few crops, it's not going to do that much good. But the devastation of crops is an important topic in what they view as the tradition of the law of war in Islam. And it matters whether you're engaged in a defensive war or an offensive one. And if you're in a defensive one, you have the gloves are off in certain ways. And one of those is that you're allowed to devastate crops, poison wells. And I think ISIS would even say allowed to mutilate bodies and burn people alive.
Yeah.
And these are things that most of the time in war and Islam and of course in other traditions too, are considered anathema. So to listen to their pronouncements, and this is not just some of them, but even these grisly beheading videos, they are just laced with allusions of this sort. And if you think of them as a group that is not religious or that doesn't draw from these traditions, then I think you will be baffled by what they say. But if you take care to understand those allusions, you'll get it. You'll understand what they're saying, and it'll actually be very clear.
This is an important theme in the article. This idea that this is not just a collection of adventure seekers or psychopaths who are, you know, using bits and pieces of Islam to justify that brutality. You say their understanding of Islam is quite coherent, and it comes, in fact, from learned interpretations of the faith. Now, this is somewhat provocative, and I'm guessing you're getting some pushback in some ways, but talk a little bit about that this is, in fact, based on text.
Yes. You know, there are more than one ways to be a Muslim literalist, and I take pains to say in the article too that most literalists in Islamic traditions today reject ISIS on theological grounds.
Sure.
But ISIS certainly has its own way of being careful about the assiduous reading of text, and they take it very seriously. They have a council of scholars that pour through documents. Just they're like the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice in the United States, and they're trying to figure out what is the justification for this practice or that. If they were really just psychopaths, if they were really just completely secular people, I think they would just abolish that office and do whatever they wish. Instead, they are looking at texts. They're trying to justify these things to themselves and to other Muslims, and most Muslims think that they have utterly failed to do that. But they do draw on the same texts. They're in this tradition. And that's what I mean when I say that they're an Islamic group.
Yeah. They often refer to what they call this prophetic methodology. Explain what that is.
Yes. So the phrase, the prophetic methodology, is something that you see all the time in their pronouncements, on their stationery, on their license plates, on the billboards that they have up in the entrance to towns controlled by them. The prophetic methodology is the idea that if you establish a caliphate along the lines of the caliphates that were established as successors to the Prophet Muhammad, then the results will be glorious. They will be approved by God, and they will usher in, first of all, success, and then eventually a kind of end times battle, where eventually Jesus will come back and come to the aid of the Islamic State. It's a sort of if you build it, they will come kind of mentality.
Graham Wood is with us. He's a contributing editor to The Atlantic magazine. His article about the Islamic State is the cover story for the March issue. You can get a link to that article on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. If you have comments or questions, you can join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Or our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking some of the most basic questions about the militant terrorist group ISIS. Just what is the Islamic State, for example? Where did it come from? What are its intentions? Because the journalist Graham Wood says most people in governments, or many anyway, misunderstand the nature of ISIS. In his cover story for The Atlantic magazine, he explores just how the Islamic State is looking to revert civilization to a 7th century legal environment, and that leaders are committed to killing vast numbers of people and ultimately bringing about an apocalypse. He's joining us today from a studio on the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut, and Graham Wood is a contributing editor to The Atlantic. You can get a link to that article on our website. Graham Wood, I wanted you to help us sort of trace the origins of ISIS, because you start with Al Qaeda, for example, that it traces its origins to Al Qaeda in some ways, but then there came this split between the two, And you mentioned that the West's failure to kind of appreciate the differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda has led to some, as you describe it, dangerous decisions. Talk a little bit about that split and the origins there.
Yes, the split took place roughly at the time when Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, who was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, really began to depart as a matter of doctrine and practice from his predecessors. We had Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, likely Ayman al-Zawahiri, his lieutenant, also in Pakistan. And what they were really aiming for was attacks in the West. They wanted 9/11 style attacks. And they thought it was important that they have an affiliate in Iraq that was resisting militarily the American occupation. What Zarqawi started to do that really rubbed them the wrong way is he started to attack fellow Muslims.
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting shift. He started to say that not only is it okay to attack Muslims who are resisting, even in slight ways like voting, for example, who are resisting Zarqawi's point of view, it's also something we should do in a really grotesque public way. And we should particularly aim for Shia and for Sufis. And so the first really big shift from Al-Qaeda to ISIS is when we started to see essentially a sectarian civil war breaking out in Iraq with the encouragement of and leadership of Zarqawi.
Right.
And Zawahiri actually wrote to Zarqawi and said, look, cut it out. This is not giving us a really good name. And so you need to stop that. And then the second thing that started to happen was that some of Zarqawi's successors started to make plans based on this apocalyptic belief. And I don't want to make it sound like Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri, that they don't have apocalyptic beliefs. They're just like most people, and their apocalyptic beliefs are really divorced from what they think is currently necessary.
Like a distant.
They think it might happen in hundreds of years and thousands of years. Whereas Zarqawi's immediate successors, they started to plan for things to start happening really within a year or two.
Right.
And Zawahiri thought that too is something that seems a little nutty. And I think it continues to be his belief that ISIS is controlled by people who share a lot of his beliefs but are crazy.
So Zarqawi really expands the acts that could get you labeled as an apostate or an infidel. And you go down this litany in the article, selling alcohol or drugs. Okay, that makes sense. I guess wearing Western clothes, shaving your beard, voting in an election. But this is, I think, one of the most chilling points that could get you labeled an infidel, being a Shiite. So if you're Shiite, if you're an apostate, according to Zarqawi, which means that they have to die. And as you point out in the article, that means, and as you said earlier in the program, essentially 200 million Shia then are marked for death, that the Islamic State is committed to killing, hundreds of millions of people.
Yes, and there's a very interesting thing in Islam about excommunication. It's not like in some other religions where you can just be very fastidious or have a very exclusionary view of the faith and just say, oh, that person's not really a Muslim. There's a widely accepted tradition of the Prophet Muhammad that says, and listen carefully to this, he says, if there are two people who call themselves Muslims and one says to the other, you're not a Muslim, then one of them is not a Muslim. And what he means by that, of course, is that if you're accusing a Muslim of not being a Muslim and you yourself are a Muslim, that is, if you make a false accusation of not being a Muslim, then you actually have removed yourself from Islam. So historically, Muslims have been very cautious about making accusations of not being a Muslim. And Zarqawi was not careful about that at all. He was practicing what I think most Muslims would call mass excommunication or mass takfir, they call it. And You ran through the list of things that might get you claimed to be not a Muslim. It's, usually you'd think of a very conservative Muslim might say that shaving your beard is a sin.
Right.
Zarqawi took that to a different level and he said, it is a sin and you should be punished for it. However, if you keep on doing it, if you tell other people, oh, it's not sinful to shave your beard, you don't have to do that. There's no Quranic or Hadith-based requirement to do that. Then you're doing something more than just being sinful in the shaving of your beard. Then you're denying the inerrancy and words of Holy Scripture. And if you do that, then you're no longer a Muslim. So that's the way, that's the logic that leads from sinfulness, like selling alcohol, to the promotion of sinfulness, which implies that you don't actually accept the Holy Scripts. And if that's the case, then if you're not a Muslim, there's only one punishment that's left. And according to the Islamic State, it's death. Yeah. And that's why we see many of the mass executions that we see is because of this practice of mass excommunication.
Do we know just how much killing is actually going on right now in the Islamic State?
The full dimensions of it are unknown, but they have gifted us with these videos that come out all the time, and I've seen far too many of them myself. You could see them too if you went on Twitter and looked in the wrong places, but they happen so frequently that I would say on an average day you would see you'd see multiple executions. Yeah, massive numbers. And those don't even include the battlefield executions, which sometimes are dozens, possibly even hundreds of people. It is an incredibly grisly scenario that's unfolding right now.
There's an ironic dimension to this, too, because you say Christians, in fact, can be spared from execution as long as they don't resist the ISIS government. They have to pay this special tax. They have to submit to this subjugation, but that's an interesting irony that Christians could, in fact, be spared under all of this.
Yes, and it really does show the emphases of the Islamic State. They want to go after ex-Muslims, Muslims who they think are hypocrites because they claim to be Muslim, but they're actually not, and Shia. These people, fellow Muslims, people who by any normal standard are Muslims, these are the main victims of the Islamic State. And when it comes to Christians, they point to the Quranic authority for this, and they say, look, here are our options. If they're not fighting against us, it is not permissible for us to just kill them. Their blood cannot be violated. What they can do, however, is if they accept that they've lost the war, then they can live with the full protection of the Islamic State in the Islamic State as long as they pay a specific tax that's meant to pay for the cost of their protection. I don't think very many Christians have taken them up on this offer. It's not really much of an offer if you can instead flee to a refugee camp somewhere or to asylum in Michigan. But, it's on the books, and the Islamic State claims that it is implementing what they call the jizya tax.
What about Jews? Where do Jews fit in this game?
Same deal, actually. Jews, and I'm quite certain that there are zero Jews who live under the Islamic State and pay the jizya tax and are saved that way. But technically, it's on the books. If a Jew were to submit to the Islamic State, then I don't see what authority the Islamic State could claim for not accepting his willingness to be subjugated and to pay that tax.
What do you make of the Christian concerns from the Christian community? I mean, the recent mass execution of these Egyptian Coptic Christians, for example, on that horrible scene on the beach. How do we understand that in the context of all of that?
Well, this is another case where I think the words of the executioner repay careful study. First of all, these Coptic Christians, they were specifically associated with the government of Abdel Fattah Sisi in Egypt, because it's true that Christians have been protected by the Sisi government, and they've been disproportionately, I think, in favor of Sisi's rule. Sisi's government is also fighting against the Islamic State, so I think that there is that guilt by association. There was also a specific mention by the executioner of this case of an Egyptian Coptic woman who had seemingly converted to Islam. It's not exactly clear what had happened, and it may have been the case that her family went, found her, kidnapped her, and is essentially holding her against her will, despite her desire to become a Muslim. And so that was adduced as evidence for the righteousness of this mass execution. And then the last thing to point out is that they were, the executioner specifically referred to the end times, and it's specifically to the return of Jesus. And this was just a last dig at Christianity, but he said, eventually, you just wait. Jesus will come back. He will abolish the jizya, the tax on Christians, because he will abolish Christianity and tell all Christians that they have things wrong. He will kill the swine, and he will break the cross. And so there's very little room for doubt about exactly what the message was in that video of the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians being brutally beheaded on the beach in Libya.
We had the religion scholar Karen Armstrong on the program not so long ago, and she makes this point in her book that, you know, wars are hardly ever fought just for religious reasons, that it's a lot more complicated than that, that it's about power and subjugation and, you know, politics and territory. But do you think it could be said, Graham Wood, that the Islamic State may be an exception to that, that its terror truly is more about religion than anything else?
I think Karen Armstrong is confusing the point a bit here by suggesting that when people say that this is a religious war or that this is a religiously motivated group, that they're saying that there's no importance to the many other factors that are involved in its creation. And I think that's really a straw man. What I'm saying is that the religious element of this group, first of all, is sincere, that it's carefully thought out, and that it's underrated as a way to understand the group and an explanatory lens for the group. But where she's right is that, of course, there are other things that need to be said about the origins of the group and of what its desires are. For example, it would never have come into being if there hadn't been this disastrous occupation of Iraq and the ensuing chaos of that and the Syrian civil war. That occupation, of course, has nothing to do with religion, but it created the space where this group could exist. Does that mean that the group is not religious? Does it mean that the group doesn't have anything to do with religion? No, certainly not. Right. The group wouldn't have existed this way if that hadn't happened, but that doesn't detract at all from their sincerity or the content of their beliefs, which is what I've described.
It's an interesting section in the article where you talk to the scholar Bernard Haeckel. He's a scholar on the group's, you know, theology and ideology, and he talks about this deeply infused religious vigor in the Islamic State. And he says something provocative, and I wanted to ask you about that. He said, and I'm sure it's going to be disputed by some, but he says the fighters in ISIS are authentic throwbacks of early Islam. And he says they're faithfully reproducing its early norms of war. War, which includes slavery, which includes crucifixion, and of course beheadings. Talk a little bit about that again, and we can maybe mention the mainstream Muslim groups, how they respond to all of that. But give us some context first.
Well, the context of this, I think, is the desire and the statements that have been made to disassociate Islam from the Islamic State, and right. Those are completely understandable. No one wants beheadings on a beach in Libya to be associated with him or his religion in any way. But Professor Haeckel is quite right that this group is attempting to revive elements that are in the Islamic tradition and that are, of course, of no interest whatsoever to most Muslims today. Things like crucifixion, beheadings, stoning of adulterers. You do not find very many Muslims, certainly not in this country, who say that adulterers should be stoned and that these practices should be revived. On the other hand, these practices are there. Yeah. They existed in a particular historical context, and that context is what ISIS is really trying to bring to the present. Things like crucifixion, slavery, they are not things that ISIS has made up. ISIS has certain fantasies about what the early caliphates and Islamic conquests looked like. And I think it's very important that historians talk about the ways in which their view of these conquests differ from what we actually objectively know about them. But Heichel's point is quite right, that there are aspects of early Islamic conquests that ISIS correctly identifies as sanctioned by the Quran in particular contexts. What they're very odd and what makes them a very fringe group is that they think that these contexts apply today.
Right.
Almost no one else believes that.
I mean, it's interesting. If the actual kind of working ideology of the Islamic State is based on, you know, a somewhat coherent reading of Muslim law and tradition, what does that mean for the thousands who are immigrating to the Islamic State from all over the world, as you point out, France and the United States and Germany and Holland and, you know, Britain? Are they also driven by a connection to, you know, that older context of Muslim law and tradition, or are there a safe to say there are a good share of psychopaths in this number, and they don't care about any of that part?
I think the number of psychopaths is perhaps overestimated. These people, they look pretty crazy because they're doing atrocities on camera. That said, the number of them who seem to believe that this is the correct reading of Islam is probably pretty high. It doesn't mean that they represent anybody or that the number in the general population of Muslims is high.
Sure.
But yeah, they have this view, and the view comes from deep suspicion of religious authority and authority in general that exists outside the Islamic State. When they see that there are Muslim scholars who are paid for by governments like Saudi Arabia, they immediately, the very fact that you have seemingly iniquitous governments, mm-hmm. that are paying for these things makes them think that scholarship has been co-opted. And that's really what ISIS is offering an antidote to for the people who are suspicious of these people. They're offering a version of Islam that has seemingly no contradictions, that reads the texts in the plainest way possible, rejecting what it regards as 1,000 or so years of innovation that has polluted the faith. If you don't tolerate hypocrisy very well, I think that the Islamic State's view of Islam will be unfortunately very attractive.
An important part of the article is the conversations you had with various people who want to emigrate to the Islamic State. Let's talk about that when we get back from a break. Graham Wood is with us, contributing editor to The Atlantic magazine. His article about the Islamic State is the cover story for the March issue, and you can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us. We're getting questions via email, radiowest@kuer.org. If you have comments, you can also call 801-585-WEST. That's the number. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Graham Wood is joining us to trace the intellectual roots of the Islamic State. He's explaining in his cover article for The Atlantic magazine why it's crucial the West understands all of this. He's joining us from a studio on the campus of Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we're getting a number of questions, I think, related to the time you spent talking to people about this desire to emigrate to the Islamic State. Jack says he thinks it would be interesting to have you talk about where you've traveled, who you've talked with, and how that's informed the way you're thinking about all of this. And you did talk to a number of people. What did you learn in those conversations?
Well, here's where I traveled. I've spent a number of years in Iraq. I've been to Syria several times. And unfortunately, I can't go to the places where the Islamic State is actually in control because for obvious reasons of my desire to stay alive. And so instead, I've had to speak to people who are overseas. And there's not a small number of people who, even if they don't admit to being members of the Islamic State, seem to agree with it on every point and will speak to me. They were able to speak to me at length about why they thought the Islamic State was the fulfillment of their religion. So I met them in London, in Melbourne, and then, of course, on the internet, on social media. it's always difficult, of course, to tell who you're speaking to, who knows what. And so it was often a matter of reading between the lines, of listening carefully to what people were saying, and trying to figure out if they have a sense of what the Islamic State stands for.
Right.
And I found enough people where I think I have a sense of a broad sense of the appeal to many, especially Westerners.
But see, the question I wondered though is, and you get at this in the article, is yes, you understand or they can express to you the importance of the caliphate. That's important. But do they understand what that means in the sense that they would have to commit to the enslavement and murder of, possibly hundreds of millions of people?
Yes, they would respond to that with a shrug. These are not stupid people. They understand the meaning of their words quite well. If I pushed them on these topics, if I asked, do you really recommend the enslavement of all these people? They would say, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And they would describe in detail what constituted proper treatment of slaves. And why slavery was the best thing to do in these conditions. It was very clear that they were not fools, that they had thought these things through carefully. And any way that I tried to challenge them on this, either on secular grounds or even if I attempted to suggest ways that Muslims would object to what they say,
yeah,
they had an answer for.
Right.
And it really goes to the psychology of, I think, of cult membership as much as anything. If you try to engage a member of a cult on the theological ground of the cult, that person is ready for that conversation.
Right.
And these people were ready for the conversations that I brought to them too.
Kathy sends this question: why would young women who want to feel powerful, why would they join an organization that viciously assaults women and completely limits their freedom? Do you have an answer to that? Did you get at that question?
Yes. So I have been in communication and have read the tweets, for example, of people who have gone, women who have gone to the Islamic State, and they would simply disagree with the characterization. They'd say that in the Islamic State they are safer than they'd ever been at home. They say that they're able to fulfill their role as mothers, for example. And they could even, in some cases, work outside the house. This is something that we would, I'm sure, in most cases, consider a pretty restrictive life, given that they have no choice in the matter but to be, keep the home fires burning, et cetera. So they would say that they aren't restricted and that they're living the fullest life they've ever had.
Let's talk about how ISIS sees the end of times, the apocalypse, which you mentioned is unlike a lot of jihadist movements in the sense that they believe the apocalypse is in fact written into God's script. It's a central character. Take us through the scenario, if you would, because you explained that essentially they're waiting for this army of Rome that will initiate this countdown to the end, and it's going to play out in this Syrian city called, is it Dabiq?
Dabiq, yes.
Yeah, near Aleppo. Explain how that's supposed to play out according to their scenario.
Much like Christianity, there is a specific apocalyptic scenario, and it involves war, lots of bad things. And in this case, they think that it's going to happen in a particular place that they already control called Dabiq. Small city in Syria, and they think it's happening fairly soon. Like, we're talking years, not decades, I think. And they think that the armies of Rome, which is how they're described in the Hadith traditions of the Prophet, that the armies of Rome will congregate around Dabiq, and there will be a massive battle there. And they believe that the armies of Islam will win against the armies of Rome. Who Rome is a really interesting question, because obviously there's, it's not the Pope.
Right.
There's no Roman Empire left. And I found some members of ISIS or supporters of ISIS who thought Rome just meant crusaders, the West, Americans will certainly do. And some who actually thought it was the Turkish army, which is an interesting and heterodox opinion. So that they think that first that battle will happen, and then there will be other battles that unfold. Of course, the defeat of a Western army by the Islamic State would mean a kind of rolling tide of conquest that would hit Istanbul, would hit the city of Rome itself. And interestingly, they think perhaps the world will be covered by Islam at that point, but perhaps not, because one element of this prophecy is that a kind of anti-Messiah will arise.
Right.
And that anti-Messiah will beat back the armies of the Islamic State and actually reduce them to almost no one. It'll be down to the last 5,000 fighters in the city of Jerusalem. And that's the cue for Jesus to return and to kill the anti-Messiah personally, to stab him, and then lead the armies of Islam to a period of righteous rule.
Wow. It's interesting you write about this. I have to say this little tidbit really intrigued me. Dabiq has lots of farmland. So I guess there'd be plenty of room for big world-ending battles, I guess, there.
Yeah, that's what one of the Twitter followers of the Islamic State said. You know, he said, look at Dabiq. It's got some big open areas. We could have a battle here.
Right.
So they're looking at it with an eye. It's like looking at real estate, that they're imagining what might happen and are imagining it in a very real, immediate way, not as a distant occurrence.
You say that the scheme that could work for the West in terms of dealing with the Islamic State is having a clear sense of that religious ideology we've been talking about. And as you mentioned in the article, the West should begin to react in a way that doesn't strengthen ISIL, but helps it to self-immolate, is how you put it. Because you mentioned that this radicalism of the Islamic State really has hamstrung the Islamic State. They can't really concede anything. They can't compromise in any way. And I suppose in some ways you could look at that if you're in the West and see that as a way of, as a vulnerability, I suppose.
Yes, I think it should fill us with confidence, actually. You know, of course, they could compromise. They could make concessions. They could recognize their borders and pledge to stay within them. But if they did that, they would be alienating huge numbers of their supporters, many of whom said to me, if that happened, then the caliphate would be invalid and
right.
We as Muslims would have to make war against it. So they would be asking for an enormous amount of insurrection, fellow jihadi insurrection, if they did that. I think the reason for optimism is that they will not be able to make some of the compromises that could allow them to survive. They will not be permitted, as a matter of doctrine, to, for example, take a seat at the UN, to exchange ambassadors, to come up with long-term durable pieces with their neighbors. Instead, they say we must. It's our raison d'être to be expanding constantly. And so if we accept borders, then we've given that away and we've invalidated our rule. No state has ever been able to survive with that kind of permanent hostility to everyone around it. And I think the Islamic State will be similar in its destruction being spelled by its inflexibility.
What do you do in the meantime while you're waiting for them to sort of implode? I mean, one thing that was interesting is if you see one of the crucial differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda was this idea of territory. You know, Osama bin Laden didn't care where you were necessarily. ISIS does. So if you're conducting a military campaign, isn't it easier to have a place to go bomb in particular, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's very important that we be cautious about going for that easy solution,
right.
Just because I don't think it's really an easy solution in the long term. There's certainly no question that we would vanquish the Islamic State, deprive it of its territory, if we wanted to send in an enormous American-led occupation, invasion of Islamic State territory. It's just that I'm not sure we really have the ability to administer that afterward in a way that would do anything but produce the same sort of chaos that gave rise to the Islamic State in the first place.
Right.
So I would say that we should probably try to dial back our confidence a bit and instead just try to make the propaganda of the Islamic State lose its bite, lose its appeal. And we can do that by making sure that their narrative, which is the Islamic State versus Crusaders, doesn't look like the reality. And we've already started to do that
by making sure that the lead is taken in the fight against the Islamic State by Muslim Kurds and by Muslims from Iraq. If you go to the Islamic State and you expect to be fighting Americans, and instead you find someone who looks a bit like you, who shares a lot of the elements of your religion, even if not all of them, then maybe you'll be less excited than looking through your gun sights at someone who's clearly a Christian and who resembles in every way what the Islamic State told you you were going to see in your enemy.
One of the things you've mentioned is that a number of ISIS supporters have commented now on your article in The Atlantic. You said they generally have approved of your analysis of the group. You said some were even delighted about that. I'm wondering, how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I'm happy about it in exactly one way. What I wanted to do was to describe ISIS accurately and to describe the group in terms that it understood and recognized as correct. Yeah. It doesn't mean to approve of them, but I think that some of the people who tweeted it out from Islamic State-affiliated accounts were just pleased that there was a description of their group that didn't describe them as a bunch of gibbering psychopaths who just wanted to make gory movies, but people who had a hugely complicated and well thought out plan for government and for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what they liked about it. Some of them pointed out, though, that in describing them that way, I was also, in a way, giving away the battle plan of how to defeat them. And
but don't they do that themselves?
They do, yes. Yeah. And that's the irony, is they're, in some ways, you know, they conceal certain things, but in some ways, their larger plan is an open book. And so for a journalist to say, here, I've just looked at their open book and here's what it said, could be very dangerous for them. And they just said in response, we're pretty confident that even if you describe us accurately, that no one will believe you. they sort of said, you'll be a Cassandra and we'll win anyway.
It's Graham Wood, contributing editor to The Atlantic magazine. His article about the Islamic State is the cover story for the March issue. You can get a link to that article on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Graham Wood, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.